Blog Talk Radio.
Threw something in there at the end. Me too. Hey, me too. Welcome to the show, brothers. How you doing, brothers? This is my life. Let everybody know right now, this is the Brothers for Real Radio Show. You're talking to Robert, Leon, and Curtis, brothers. Curtis, most of the time. Sometimes we invite a couple other brothers in. We got Daniel to show up every now and then. So I'd like for you to please join us tonight as we talk. Please
and you
call in and talk to us tonight. We don't want
Joseph
to sit here and talk. Joseph over there. Joseph, how you doing, man? Yeah, you got Joseph, too. I keep it's a lot of us, man, when it's just four.
We're doing great, man. Good to be here this evening.
Thank you, sir. It's a lot of Gateway brothers, only when it's four. He does something.
Yeah.
Wow. Curtis, how you doing, man?
Hey, Leon.
Curtis.
Hey, Joseph.
How you doing,
Robert,
man? You guys kind of slow.
Daniel.
What's up, brothers? People? We tired.
And to our sisters who may not be on the line, hello, Gateway sisters, everybody.
Right.
And to listeners, we love you. All right.
Right, man. Thank you, guys. Look, guys, I like to just say hello. I like to let everybody know I went to see Mom this week. Mom's doing great. Beautiful lady. 98 years old. If you want to make Mama laugh, just say, Mama, you're almost 100. And she'll just break out laughing without fail. Almost 100, man. Can you imagine having a mother that's almost 100?
That's all mama.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Brother, we're going to talk some real talk tonight. I'm going to start off talking about politics right quick. I'm going to give y'all something that happened today in Anson County. Mike Huckabee came to Anson County today, man. Y'all know that dude?
Whether he lost, made a wrong turn or what happened? Running from the police?
It was definitely a wrong turn. He didn't know it was wrong. he did not realize what a wrong turn it was. But it was definitely a wrong turn. But
they might have a missing person out on that, Joker. Because how old is he? About 90.
It was two Huckabee. That was a Huckabee and the old man and the son Huckabee. Isn't there two of them?
Hold to a word.
I don't know. But he's talking about the Huckabee that ran for president probably in 2008, came out like in the top three with McCain and
right,
so on and so forth.
He ain't supposed to be a preacher
or
something.
Yeah,
he's
supposed to be a preacher.
Supposed to be a preacher.
Yeah, supposed to be a preacher, man. I'm going to tell you how tainted. He know he's tainted. Let me tell you what he said about coming down here.
Why was he there, Leon?
Huh? I'm going to tell you what he said now. He said he was in North Carolina today campaigning with Mark Harris. He's running for U.S. House. Well, you know, we don't like to call the – anyway, we're nonpartisan here tonight. Anyway, he said he's down here campaigning for Mark Harris. He's running for one of those House seats. And here's what he said about himself. He said he told Mark, "I will campaign for you or against you, whichever one helped." Now you talking about desperate. He said, "Whatever, if I campaign for you, if it'll help you, I'll do it. If I campaign for you, if I campaign against you, if that'll help you, I'll do that. Just let me help you."
Well,
see, I know he's tainted.
In other words, he ain't got no morals.
Man.
He'll just do anything.
Stand for anything.
Anything. Boy, that's disgusting.
He'll do anything.
Mm. You can't put nothing in the nothing he says. He just going whichever way that works. No integrity.
Right, right.
No
exactly
integrity.
Right.
Let's talk about something else, man.
Hey, y'all remember Huckabuck? We used to play basketball. You do the Huckabuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I remember that.
We did it.
Willie Lee, the only one I knew that could really do it, though.
Yeah. Willie Lee, a Huckabuck.
Yeah.
A Huckabuck up a store. You go up in there and you hold the ball until the last minute, then you throw it around.
Yeah, he was so short, though. He had to come up with something.
Yeah.
Huckabuck.
He had to come up with a trick, man.
Yeah, was short and muzzled.
You said Huckabee, I think about Huckabuck for some reason.
Yeah, that when you went way back, bro. We threw you back.
Way back.
We threw you way back.
Way back, man. Way back.
Let me tell y'all this right quick, man. We have Curtis
is,
Gatewood. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, tell you about that Huckabee visit, too. You know, I've been down here with Leon and the group of people in Anson County who are trying to do what they can to hold on to the righteous side of history and not sell their souls to the devil and try to do the right thing. And that's not partisan. It's just trying to do the right thing and look out for people who are most vulnerable, people who are less likely to have the means to afford health care, housing, and the basics, but try to make sure they're not walked upon, trampled upon, and left out in the cold. So these are people who are trying to do that. And through their votes, they are trying to vote in certain people. A lot of them happen to be Democrats at this particular point in our history, but we do know that pendulum can change at any time because we do know the history. So when people tell us, well, you know, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, they were Republicans, we know the history. But the fact of the matter is the pendulum has swung, and the same Democrats that took over Wilmington are not necessarily Democrats of today, and the same Republicans that helped to free the slaves are not the same Republicans we have today. So that's why I'm for justice. So anyway, but to make a long story short, Huckabee came because these Republicans up here really needed help. There's a serious group of African Americans and other people who are working the polls here in Anson County. They are really serious about what they are doing. They're diligent. They're making sure that they educate people on the positions when they come to the polls. So I think they call for backup. That's what I believe. Because
sure
people supposed to be, they came out here with this big Trump Pence sign as if Trump is running for office. Somebody, they didn't get the memo that Trump and Pence not running this year, evidently. But anyway, they're out there with this big Trump Pence sign as if that's supposed to attract voters when it's probably running more away. We're glad that they brought that sign. But anyway, so then they brought in Huckabee today because I think the word is out that Wadesboro is moving the votes. And they're moving the votes in the right direction. So they're trying to do what
Absolutely.
They can to deter the momentum of the people who are getting out the vote here in Anson County.
And it's not working. It's not working. Matter of fact, it fired me up. So fired up. We got so fired up, man. It's just amazing to see what's going on. And Curtis, I just want to thank you for coming down, man, because you're really generating a lot of excitement by being in the community. I mean, really a lot of excitement about being in the community. This guy, man, I mean, when he showed up, I mean, it's like people saying, man, we got help. We got all the help we need. We got Minister Gatewood in the house. So we really appreciate you coming down and joining our fight
man,
for justice,
man.
Man,
to God be the glory, man. I love Wadesboro. I love home. I love you. I love my family. This is our home turf. We're not going to let the devil take it. We're not giving it up to the devil. So we're going to be here. And the devil does not necessarily mean Republican or Democrat, but people know who they are when I say the devil. You know you're doing wrong. You know you're trying to hurt people who are most vulnerable. You know you're trying to keep certain people in prison and oppressed. You're working for the devil. It's just that simple. So So we're here to say this is not a war of flesh and blood. This is a spiritual war, a war against evil principalities, evil people in high places. So we're here to say we are not going to give Wadesboro away. This is the home of our father, our mothers, and we're going to be here to protect our homeland.
You're a bad man, Doc. You're a bad man. I appreciate you being here. Brothers, look, we want to talk a little bit about growing up in the 70s. Do you guys remember the 70s? I know, Robert, Joseph, I know you guys have some really fond memories of the 70s, especially as growing up as youth in the 70s in the school system. Now, when you guys were at Bowman, I was at Anson. I was what did they call it back then? Anyway, I was over at the, what did he call it back then, man?
Anson,
I was over at Anson.
Anson Middle School.
Junior High, that's what it was.
Yep.
Yeah, I was over at Anson Junior High when you guys were over there doing all that freedom fighting at the high school. And those were the days that, you know, and what I was trying to make the point of was as crazy as racism and Jim Crow and all that stuff was back then, I personally, you know, I could have been a little naive, but I personally did not get the brunt of it. I did not get a lot of what I would consider moments of racism that stick out in my head.
Right.
Could have been a little naive, but like I said, I didn't get it. And I want to have a discussion with you guys tonight. Did you personally get any? I can't sit here and say, man, I was just discriminated against.
Hey, let me chime in quickly, Leon.
Yeah.
I would say that you were affected indirectly because racism is systemic. It's a system, and even though nobody may have knocked you upside the head or put on a Klan outfit and darkened your doorway, you were being affected by through your dad, through job opportunities, through educational opportunities.
Yeah.
So when you're facing a system, it's not tangible. It's an intangible, and it's ways unseen as well as seen. So you're not being naive, but when you're talking about racism, it's more covert than somebody actually burning a cross in your yard or denying you a job or calling you an N-word to your face.
The N-word. Hey, so, I want to say something before Joseph chimed in, because I know Joseph had a lot to say on this subject, because I will say with Joseph, Aaron, and Robert, those guys actually inspired me to become an activist. I don't know if they know that or not, but I will give them credit for that, because if they had been drug dealers, chances are I'd probably be one of the most notorious drug dealers out here. But they were out there actually as youth council NAACP members fighting, and I remember them actually planning the boycott or the walkout of the school, looking over their shoulders as they made plans to take direct action against racism in the school system. And that,
right.
And I was a little boy. I was in the fifth grade, I think. I mean, I don't know if you were, but I put it like this: I do remember during my fifth grade year, that's when I had my front. I confronted racism. Because that was the first year we had so-called integration or desegregation. And all the people in my classroom were basically white, except for about three. And it was just night and day. The teachers knew me from the first through the fourth grade. They knew my brothers, my sisters. They showed me love. They really acted like they cared about me. They knew my mama. They knew my daddy. And I'm not saying that to say the other teachers who came in, the white teachers, was automatically supposed to know my mom and my dad and all those things. But they made no effort, and they just talked about the other students in my class who was Hart Taylor. He was the son of Pat Taylor, Lieutenant Governor. Ed Davis, he was the son of the doctor in the physician in our town, Dr. Davis. Harvey Levitt, he was the son of the white undertaker in our town who was prominent. All these were white prominent children. And the teacher always commended them on their parents. They talked about them, and I just sat over there basically in the corner. All of a sudden, nobody knew Reverend Gatewood. Nobody knew my smart sisters and siblings. And it was just such a contrast. And if I answered a question, there was never like, yes, like I got in the fourth grade. It would be like, well, what you say, Hart? What you say, Pat? You know, that type of thing. It was subtle. And the teacher always would use the term, she wouldn't say nigger, but she said niggers. Niggers. And that bothered me. And that's, she always said niggers. It was Miss Matthews. I don't know where they were. But she, I never forgot her, because that was the first year I had to confront what I knew in my soul. I didn't know quite what it was, but I knew I was mistreated all of a sudden, and I knew that all the people around me were white. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to go in now, Chola. I guess I was a little naive. I heard that word a couple of times, but now that you're digging it back up on me, what? When I felt discriminated against, I was in the spelling bee. And I was, you know, young. I was winning, man. I was knocking the words out. You know, elephant and, you know, big words like that. And then the teacher threw a word on me, bourgeois, out the clear blue.
Elephant bourgeois. Is a big animal, not a bird, but go ahead.
Oh, bourgeois. Anyway, she threw bourgeois on me, man.
Hey.
Now y'all know that wasn't in there on the list. That wasn't on the list.
Huh? She would call you a bougie nigga. She put it on the list.
Anyway, I still don't know how to spell it.
I would have learned how to spell it if I were you.
What?
That would have been a good one to learn how to spell.
Give me trauma, man. It would give me trauma, man, when I think about it.
But
Leon needed a hug after that one.
Yeah.
But
in
1970, I was 17 years old, and when 1970 came in, I was 17 years old, and at 17, that's when I became the president of the Anson County Youth Chapter of the NAACP, and we had some very interesting things going on during that time. Matter of fact, I think it was 72 when the 18-year-olds were first eligible to vote in the United States, according to the constitutional amendment that made the 18-year-olds eligible to vote. And we had a big registration drive trying to get these 18-year-olds to vote. And Shirley Chisholm was running for president, you know, somewhere during that period. And Jesse Helms, in 1972, that was the first year, he became senator from North Carolina. And during the 70s, you know, as the president of the Youth Council of the NAACP, we worked very hard trying to get 18-year-olds registered to vote, especially to vote against Jesse Helms. And of course, we all know how that story ended. We didn't, because Jesse Helms was down from near Anson County, right over in the adjoining county, Union County. He's from Wingate,
right.
North Carolina. So we knew all about Jesse Helms. And also, we had Reginald Hawkins, a black man that was running for the governor of North Carolina. And of course, he was running against Anson County's so-called favorite son, Pat Taylor. And of course, everybody wanted to vote. Everybody was behind Pat Taylor. And of course, we had what we called our little, something similar to a black political caucus down in Anson County. And so we met to try to determine which candidate we were going to support for governor. And the president of the NAACP at that time, Ms. Ada Ford, she was not able to attend, and she asked me to stand in for the NAACP at age 17. And, of course, I went, and one of the most memorable times that I remember, I had to go toe-to-toe against business people and attorneys in Anson County to try to convince them to support Reginald Hawkins for governor as opposed to our so-called favorite son, Pat Taylor. And we won out. We won out. And Anson County decided to support Reginald Hawkins, a black man, for governor of North Carolina. Of course, now, he didn't win, but he got enough votes in Anson County that the Anson Record made a note of it, that how well Reginald Hawkins, a black man running for governor, did in Anson County.
Wow.
And of course, in that time, you know, we were faced with things like voter suppression. I remember Aaron and I, we were down near Casino Field because there was a girl down there told us she went to vote and she they told us she couldn't vote at that location. So Aaron and I, we were manning the phones up at the NAACP office. So we jumped in that little beige station wagon, drove all the way down to drove all the way down to Morgan, somewhere down near Casino Field, back down in that long way. And we picked that girl up and took over to what she thought she was registered to vote. And that lady, they wouldn't let her vote there, but they told her what she could vote. And, of course, and
wow.
We took over there. But we had a lot of interesting stuff going on in the 70s. Like I said, you know, that was when Shirley Chisholm, first African-American and female to run for president, Reginald Hawkins running for governor, and of course, and doing everything we could to keep the notorious Jesse Helms from being elected. So we were very active back then.
Well, we're glad you didn't do everything you could have done. Let me ask you this, Joe. Now, I noticed you said you were doing that stuff when you were very young in NAACP. Seemed like you ran a store. You did a lot of stuff young. Didn't you used to run that store when you were about six?
Yeah, no, I was older than that. I was in the sixth grade. Of actually what happened
My bad.
Mom and mother and I were running the store, and Mama got sick. And when Mama got sick, because I wasn't like Mama's assistant, and when Mama got sick, I was in the sixth grade. So when Mama
Your
went
mama
out,
was
I
assistant.
Yeah, I was a happy mother. Mama was running the Mama was the main person running the store. Because first, you know, you remember Roy Hammond. See, Roy Hammond had a store. And so his daddy just, you know, made a deal with Miss Hammond, and she took that store over. And so mother, you know, mom for the most part had just worked in the home. And so, you know, that pretty much gave mama something to do to get out of the house. And, of course, I think that's what daddy's biggest plan was. But, but mama got sick, and when she got sick, I just stayed on it there and kept running it. And then Aaron came on as my assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so Aaron and I, you know, we ran that store. We marketed. We brought in we paid the vendors that came in, the milkman, the bread man, counted up the money, counted up the inventory. When we got a loan bread, got a loan milk, you know, we ordered. We did everything. And the amazing thing about it was that people in the community never treated me like I was a kid. I mean, grown people would come in that store and they would respect me. They would talk to me just like I was running the store, and I was in the sixth grade.
Did you ever have any shoplifters?
Yeah, we had shoplifters. we had shoplifters, and most of the time, you know, the thing we told them, you know, hey man, put it back, man. I mean, the ones we caught. Now, I'm sure there was some we probably didn't catch. But, yeah, people would try to steal from. But one of the biggest challenges we had was, going back to racism, the bread man, because Aaron and I, we were, you know, cause like I said, we were in charge of inventory and everything. So we start noticing that our bread was spoiling too quick. Started having holes. Because, see, and what he's supposed to do is come in and take out the old bread and bring in fresh bread.
Uh-oh.
I told Aaron, I said, Aaron, I think that this man is bringing the same bread back in the store. And so what I did, I put a little small dot on every loaf of bread. Put a little small dot on every loaf of bread. A real small, so small that he wouldn't be able to see it. And so he took all that bread out in the truck and brought it back in. And I pointed it out to him. I said, I said, we noticed that our bread had been spoiling too quickly. I said, so what I did, I said, you see this little dot on here? I said, I put this dot on if you would.
Hey, boy.
And he looked at me. He turned red. He didn't say a word. He picked that bread up and took that bread back out to his truck. And from that point on, we started having fresh bread like we supposed to.
Come on, buddy. Can we give him a hand?
I confronted that. This is powerful. I confronted that guy about the fresh bread, and I was in the.
Here.
But anyway, Leon, thank you for bringing that up.
But that is
great.
That was great.
Look, guys, we're going to take a little break here for a second and come back. We want to talk about, this is going to get into something here. We're going to, it's a little touchy situation, this the Me Too movement. What we really want to talk about, I hope some ladies will come in and chat with us a little bit. We want to talk about how do we maneuver around, what's acceptable now? I mean, you do women want compliments anymore? Can you say, wow, you look great today? You look better without stockings on. Can you say that anymore? I don't know.
Don't say that.
Yeah, I really like you without pantyhose on. Look that close. Wait a minute.
But we got a lot to talk about.
What kind of world we living in?
I like to talk about some of that.
You are single.
Oh, that's true. Okay, then, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. You're talking to the brothers, the Gatewood brothers, Robert, Curtis, Joseph, and Leon. We'll be right back. All right.
Amen. Good show, fellas.
When the Mac movie out in the 70s, guys, the Mac. Now, he'd have some problems these days. The Mac. Yeah, I remember the Mac. That was a cool devil, man.
What was Mac? What was his profession? Wasn't he a pimp?
Yeah, he was a pimp, man.
Pimp.
Yeah.
That's a show we need to have, too, the black exploitation era. You know, we were being hypnotized into believing that it's cool to be a pimp. And followed the civil rights movement. Going from Malcolm to the Mac. So go ahead, Rob.
I'll tell a quick story about that. I was running for president of my senior class.
Mm-hmm.
And just to tell you
high
how
school.
Intoxicating... High school, yes. How
okay.
intoxicating these movies were. I had my campaign manager, I think he was self-appointed, Vernon Parson.
Yeah.
And he was going to make me a nice sign.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy could draw. He was talented. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
guy was so talented. I really, every time I think about him, he was a musician, he was an artist. And but like I said, back then, we didn't have the support systems to encourage
and foster
this type of talent. So anyway.
That's right.
But anyway, he drew this campaign poster for me. He drew a guy that looked like me, but he had on an outfit like the Mac. He had
mm-hmm.
a big old brim mm-hmm. on and a coat and platform shoes, and right up there above
Amen.
His head, he had a sign that said Pimp Street.
Oh, wow. Now, he was doing all right. He was on point until he put that on top of your head, because that's the way you guys walked around, man. You and Aaron.
I know.
Walked around
like
the Mac.
And
but
so the principal came up to me and said, he said, "You can't put that on top of this sign." I'm standing by there. Why not? That's
right.
It was almost like the rappers nowadays, how they defend their culture. It was like, that's all we knew. That's what we knew. And so to make a long story short, he said, "Look, you can keep the sign, but you got to take the word pimp off it." And that's what we did. But that was one of those defining moments of the 70s.
Right.
We were torn. We were facing this cognitive dissonance. We were being pulled apart by these opposing thoughts. We didn't know what was good and bad because our brains were being inundated with these type of images of who the hero was.
Did you win, Robert?
Huh?
Did you win?
I won.
You won. I'm gonna tell you my story. I'm gonna tell you my. I watched the movie Superfly, man. I'm almost embarrassed to tell this, but anyway. You know, the guy, the Mac, the pimp, whatever he was, the Superfly guy. He snorted coke constantly in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He snorted coke constantly. And what did I always take for my headaches? Goody powder.
Man,
so I thought it might help fine if I snorted it.
Lord have mercy.
We should be patting all each other on the back that we made it through the 70s, and we sit here today and talk about
it. And I'm going to break this up right now. And then, see, that's what's going on with our kids. Now, see, that wasn't really mainstream. You know, it was kind of, you know, mama and them didn't listen to it. And when I say mainstream, I'm going to define it for you. We couldn't watch that around the house.
That's true.
That would not have been seen around the house. But see, what the kids are going through now, the stuff that they're being exposed to is in the house. And everywhere else they go.
On their phones,
so they have been
their TVs, their computers, they're
everywhere, man.
You're totally integrated.
So when somebody wants to take control of our community now, it's easy. It's easy, man. We gotta fight back some kind of way. We gotta fight back. But like you guys say, as we know, it's easy to be influenced by that. Because you admire it. I mean, like, man, look at that joker there.
Yeah, we dressed
him up. Look at Snoop Dogg. Look at whoever these guys are. Lil Jon and them. They walk around with their pants and stuff hanging down in their hair like that. You know, it's exciting. So that's what they do.
Hey, man, I got one more quick story. One more quick 70s story.
Let's hear it, man. I like these. I'm loving these stories, man.
I was a shoe shine boy. Worked over at the barbershop, the white barbershop.
Andy's
barbershop. Very good.
Yeah, I remember.
And
I remember.
His son, Steve Shewing, I think it was. Yeah, Shewing. He was one of the barbers. He was the son of one of the barbers. And this happened right in the advent of integration. I was going into the seventh grade. That summer when I went to work for the barbershop, the year before I worked, I was at Faison School, which was the black school in town. And so the little white barber's son would run around the barbershop. He never spoke to me. He just kind of, I guess I was just like the pet or something. You know, he walked by, probably pet me on the head or something. But he was, I mean, we were the same age. We were the exact same age. But there was no rapport at all. How do you speak to the pet, right? So I was cleaning up the hair, but I was getting paid. And I was being instilled this entrepreneurship because it was my shop. It was my little stand. I kept the money, and all I had to do was sweep the place up to keep the hair off the floor, and that was my rent. That's how I paid the rent. And all the money I made was mine. And so that summer, when it was over, when I went to school that next year, it was the first year of integration for me. And I'm walking down the hall with my chest stuck out. I had my little new TJ Flag outfit on or whatever I bought that summer, and feeling pretty proud that I was an independent young black man. And I see this little shoeing guy, and he was with his boys. I'm kind of with my boys. And he yells out at the top of his voice, "Hey, there's Shan." I said, "Oh, Lord."
Oh, pimp daddy walk around. But call him Shan. That's messed up.
Wow.
What'd
say,
you do,
Rob?
Man? Robert.
Well,
what'd you do, man?
He said,
never mind.
He said,
I don't
hey.
Talk about it on radio. You need
counseling. Hey, Leah. He said, hey.
Robert.
Oh.
Oh, man. I think we lost him.
Hey, Leon.
It wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
Pretty bad, man. He gone, man.
You know,
right.
Well, you know, every successful person shines shoes at some point.
That's true.
I mean,
Wait a minute, man. I'm serious. Where Robert at, man? He gone.
Leon.
She went, boy. I might have heard.
No, Leon. I want to kind of get back to the issue where you just got off. You talked about the Me Too movement.
Yeah, we're going to get back to that, man. But let's find Robert, man. He disappeared on us.
He probably just off. Man, he'll get on. We can't wait. I mean, I guess he'll come back, all right. Hey, Robert.
He's the boss, man. You got to wait on the boss, man. This ain't belt, man. We can't have the bosses away sale.
Well, it's just telling folks have done worse things than Chan Chu to make it through. Even though
might
I've never done it.
He might be having a moment, man.
Yeah, he might be crying.
He done gone off the air, man.
White boy call you Shine and you trying to be cool. Man.
Okay. He's back, man. Rob,
man.
Back, man.
Man, I was on a roll. Where did I stop off? Where did I cut off?
You were,
yeah,
man.
You
said that
a
boy called you Shine, man, and then you just went into a moment.
Oh, man. All right, I'll be quick this time.
Thought you fainted,
anyway,
man, and went and jumped off a building. So. It wasn't that bad.
No, but the guy called me Shine, and I don't know how far I'd gone, but I had my chest stick out at that point. I'm like, I'm Reverend Gatewood's son, and I was carrying all this pride, but back then, calling somebody Chan was almost a mild version of the N-word, because my boys
That's
were
true.
With me. They didn't know what Chan was. They didn't know me as a Chan. They knew me as Robert Gatewood.
Because they didn't get their hair
son.
Cut over there. Right.
Huh? No, it was. No,
because they didn't get their hair cut over there, so you kind of closet Chan.
Yeah, it was a white barbershop.
Yeah,
so,
I know what I'm saying. They didn't.
It was like my little secret, my little private world. And so when this tuning guy called me and said, "Hey, Chan," I mean, I was totally humiliated. I was totally humiliated. And I didn't. My brain was going a mile a minute. I'm like, "What do I do in this situation?" I'm torn between what to do. And I made a promise then, because in my young mind, I was not accepting the fact that this guy was calling me something. But it was me. It was who I was. And so I made a decision right then that changed the trajectory of my life. I said, this will never happen again. This will never happen again. I said to myself right then, if what I'm doing, I'm ashamed to do it, I'm not going to do it.
So that was your invitation of life moment.
Absolutely. I have held ground on that from that day forward. I said, if I'm ashamed to do it, I'm not going to do it, period. And I have not wavered from that to this day.
You're bad, man. Can you give yourself a hand, Robert?
Man, give me a hand. Where my applause? That gun. I think I said it better the first time. You know you can't redo it. I was on a roll the first time.
That was wonderful, man. That was good. We're gonna, Robert. We're gonna talk Me Too, but I gotta tell this story right here since you're telling your story. I worked at Roses. When I was in some grade, man, and I had this big afro, and one day the boss came up to me, who was a white guy. He just came up to me, he said, "Leon, you need to get a haircut." And I said, "Yes, sir," and I got my haircut.
So what's the moral of this story?
Where are you going with that?
You
want me that punch?
I wanted to give you a clap, man, but
I thought you were gonna say you didn't cut your hair, man.
I cut it, man.
Did you cut his hair?
Let him go to hell.
I cut it. Matter of fact, I went home and told Daddy to cut it. You know, I wanted to cut bad. I wanted my job.
What?
I had to get that job up before I let Daddy come.
Me too, man. Now I'm saying me too. Man, I've been scarred for life with a daddy's haircut.
If that's the only way I could have kept that job, I would have just let it go. Daddy cut my hair.
That was terrible.
Man, they thought
the man almost fired me when I came back, though. Benny almost fired me because of my haircut. That's what it felt like.
That's one thing I could not figure out about Daddy. I hate to get off the subject. I'm saying, how do you have 10 boys and never learn how to cut hair?
He didn't care, man. He didn't care.
I used to try to play sick till my hair grew back.
You know what?
No wonder you flunked out.
I called myself,
I
had a girlfriend,
sick.
Right?
I feel sick.
And Daddy cut my hair. And she came to me, Joseph, don't you think you're too old for your daddy to still be cutting your hair?
Right, that was nice.
I remember the first real haircut I got in 1975 when my brother Aaron died. Daddy didn't feel like crying. He couldn't see for the tears or something, and he sent me to the barbershop, man.
Great.
Man, I have a confession, guys. I have never had my hair cut by a barber in my life.
What?
Yeah.
What's the story about the goat? Y'all heard the story about the goat. I don't have to tell the story about the goat. I wouldn't have told that, man.
I try to look at my head, you probably say, I see now. That explains some things. But
I've been wondering.
I've been wondering about them haircuts you had, Robert.
a big old gap in the side of my head. One side walk.
Like Sugarfoot.
I think Bobby Brown can get away with it. I was gonna claim a Bobby Brown. You know, he got that wop side of haircut by mistake. So I had my Bobby Brown moment at the ready.
I guess that what happened to Sugarfoot with Ohio players too, man.
I've been thinking Robert had a hair disease.
Hey, man.
Thought he had tattle.
All right, brothers, look, we're getting ready to get into a serious moment here. We're going to talk about Me Too, the Me Too movement. And then when I say talk about the Me Too movement, but I didn't realize that was a lip twister. The Me Too movement. Basically, we just want to talk discuss amongst ourselves, your perception of it. How do you talk about that now? How do you deal with that in your workplace, in your, you know, everyday lives? I mean, is anything changing with you, the way you approach women or speak to women?
Can I answer that question?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I'm sure you and yeah, sure.
The way I see the Me Too movement, the way that I have always approached women has not changed. And I don't anticipate it changing because I feel that I have always treated women with respect and dignity. So as long as you do that, you don't have to worry about the Me Too movement or anything. You just understand that a woman, you should treat a woman with the same respect and dignity as you treat anybody. Now, of course,
Here's my thing on that, Joseph.
Acknowledge that a woman is a woman. I'm not, because like I say, and you know, and sometimes I will say, "Thank you, darling," or that looks beautiful you have on. Your hair looks nice. I'm not gonna change that. And if a woman gets upset with me,
well,
you're
going to jail. You're going to jail.
I just had to go.
You're going to jail.
tell the judge, I said, lady had on a beautiful dress, and I told her the dress was beautiful. She had a nice hairstyle. I said, nice. And I said, I've always addressed women sometimes. I might say, thank you, darling. I thank you, sweetheart. I might say something like that. And I said, I'm not going to change that. That's my
chime in on him, Curtis. Chime in on him, Curtis. Help him out.
That's my position.
Let's hear your perspective. I believe that.
I don't see nothing about it. What I'm saying is, because, see, women do the same thing. It's like,
women
talk to me all day. They say, thank you, love. Thank you, darling. Thank you, sweetheart. Things of that nature. They say it all the time. So
you're going to jail. Oh.
If I just go to jail, I just say that I'm going to jail. But I'm not. But what I'm saying, I've always treated women. I'm going to tell you something I do not do. I don't never touch a woman unless she gives me permission. Just like, for example, even in business, if a woman approaches me, I don't even reach out to shake her hand unless she reaches out to shake her hand. You know how a lot of people run? A lot of people run to and hug it and all that. I don't do that. If a woman,
see, we hug us down here, Joe. We hug us down here in Waysburg, man. We hug.
See, I don't do that. I'm sorry, I gotta have it.
I'm calling
the
jail.
I
have a habit of
hugging, and I don't know her. I'm not gonna do that.
Well, you can't hug strangers. What about somebody? I'm a hugger. I must admit, I'm a hugger, and I always keep that hand up above the right down the shoulder blade. If I'm hugging, I don't be going down to the waist or hitting them on the back side.
Yeah, you lean back a little bit, right in the midsection.
Yeah, do the church hug. Do the hurt church hug.
Poke it back.
And I usually do like a one arm hug, like just like around the shoulder. But I don't do a whole
arm. Yeah, you don't
round
and pull them up against you like that, like you're doing a slow dance, right?
Sure,
you don't do that.
I do like a round the shoulder hug.
No,
but I don't do the whole front thing.
Hug.
But I think that the Me Too movement has not affected me. I've always, like Joe pretty much, I've always shown respect to women, and I haven't really changed anything. But I'm always aware of the possibilities, and even though, like I say, I'm a hugger by nature, I always use like a hug pat on the back. It's almost like a combination hug pat on the back. But certain people that are total strangers, and I'm telling you, sometimes I have caught myself almost hugging somebody, and I'm saying, I probably shouldn't hug this. I don't really know this person like that, and I will stop.
Yeah,
but people like I
Where's
know and been around all day. Yeah, so I'm not trying to. But it does make you think. I haven't changed anything, but I'm always aware of it. And if somebody, I don't want to invade anybody's space. I'm not going to do anything. Try not to put myself in a compromising position. But for advice sake, I think even in my case, it's probably best if you don't hug, particularly if somebody you don't know.
That's right.
Yeah, no, man. I know. Sometimes, you just get carried away. You just hug somebody, man. But it's not like out of disrespect. It's just like that's how we were brought up down here in the country. See, I'm still down here in the country. That's what we do, kind of. Curtis, I know,
you might end up in jail, too. But yeah.
I'm going to jail. Talk about it. I think this is what I think
about any movement. Whether it's Me Too, whether it's LGBTQ, whether it's immigrant rights, Latinos, black people, black men. I think the key is always have any oppressed group of people in mind whenever you start a movement, and you not call for something that could create a backlash to another oppressed group. This is what I mean when I say this. If Me Too says, bleed women, I'm just saying, I'm not saying Me Too is saying that, but somebody is, bleed women.
Yeah.
If somebody puts that blanket demand out there that you bleed women, that's a problem. Because when you do that, you are not taking into consideration of other oppressed groups like black men who have historically been falsely accused either through racism or through retaliation or various other reasons. And unlike white, rich, powerful men, poor people and poor black men are more likely to have a harsher penalty toward them if they are accused versus a man who has power, money, and would never have to sacrifice any income or resources, such as a Donald Trump, such as a Kavanaugh, such as a Bill O'Reilly, and all these other powerful white men. So if a woman says they did it, the reaction to that woman is going to be a lot different, and a reaction to the man is going to be a lot different if it's a poor black man or a poor child, as in the 9-year-old. That's just, we had just had a case recently right there in New York, case in point. 9-year-old black youth is accused of feeling a white woman on her behind. Had it not
Thank
been
God.
A video, that young
Thank
man would have been up the creek. But there was a camera in the store that helped him to prove that he did not grope the lady as she had accused. But if that was one of those Me Too or whatever kind of movement, which is just say, believe women, then that young man would have had, and that was just almost like an Emmett Till moment right there in the current form. So my thing is to women and to everyone else, we have to always be on the side of making sure we have due process, that everyone is heard. Do not allow our feelings and our emotions of being victim of whatever oppression or abuse cause us to ask for a form of or a solution that is unjust. It's always just to ask for a fair process for everyone. What the problem has been is women had not been given a fair process in the past. If there's a white boss or a powerful boss, it could be black or any race, someone is molesting or abusing or doing something sexually offensive to a woman, the man oftentimes could get off because it would either not be told, or if it was told, it wouldn't be believed. Well, now we don't want to go from one extreme to the other to say just believe women. So what we need to do is always allow the woman to be heard, allow the man to be heard, and have a process that is fair so that all parties will be satisfied. And the goal should be not to say women won or men won, is that you want the truth to win. You want the facts to win. So you always should be after the facts, not after whether the man is right, whether the woman is right. You want justice. That's all.
Well, let me ask you this, bro. Ask you the same question everybody else has answered. Have you changed your actions or manners or way around women since the Me Too movement? Are you more concerned?
Absolutely not. I have not.
You have not.
I have not.
Okay.
Because guess what? Even in the workplace, I don't even joke with women. I don't tell women jokes. I don't get into how good you're looking. I don't get into any of that. So I didn't have to change. But that doesn't mean you would not be accused. But I'm just saying, I have not had to change.
Yeah, you're no fun at work. Yeah.
No, I'm not.
You're not, man.
Since Curtis, we kind of tying into some of the other ills of society, when Curtis was talking about the justice and how rude sometimes black people tend to be judged more harshly. If I think about the parallel of the crime of drug possession, and back during the late 80s and early 90s, when people were pretty much fed up with drug dealers and crack cocaine, and they said, "Look, we're gonna lock up all the bad guys. We're gonna lock them up and throw away the key." And look what happened.
Exactly,
we always end up on the wrong end of the
locked up everybody but
overly punished. Yeah. That's why I say the solution can never be anything that will overly punish the oppressed groups of people. And that's what exactly the 1994 crime bill did. They went right, and they were able to use people having drive-by shootings and problems with drugs to actually have a whole war against black men.
It was a dragnet.
And people stood by and watched it happen, and they packed the jails with black men who are still there today.
That's true. That is true.
And white guys reacting the same. Yeah, and the same guy, check this out, man. They made it clear they were being racist, and people accepted it because of Democrats or whatever. That's why I say I don't get caught up in a whole lot of party stuff. I want to know, are you doing the right thing? Because I think a lot of that passed because Bill Clinton had come and been playing the saxophone with sunglasses on. He knew the black national anthem without having to look at the words. He was coming to people's churches. He was doing all the things that would psychologically make you believe that he is for us. But when in actuality, the policies were not for us. And so we were caught off guard because we had a so-called moderate Democrat in the White House signing these bills. But we should have been marching just as hard the day he put his pen on that bill as we are marching against Trump or anybody else who's doing something that would actually impact the rights of black people.
Well, you know what, Kerry?
I have an interesting question. Go ahead, Rob.
Can I come in one minute on that?
Quick, Joe. I just want to tie in what Curtis is saying. Quickly, we have to remember, too, Curtis, though, I think the overreaction was really almost none, was bipartisan and without regard to race. Because there were just as many black people that were swept up in that emotion.
Yeah.
About,
like they're doing now, Robert, but the same thing is happening now. Black people are buying into this believe women stuff.
Yeah.
When
it
ain't nothing wrong with believing women, but you believe women when they are telling the truth. You believe men when they're telling the truth. You believe LGBTQ when they're telling the truth. There's no gender on earth that would tell the truth all the time. So you got to take it case by case. And so the same thing with drugs. They just swept up all the guys. All you had to do be accused of having possession, having paraphernalia. It did not matter. And these people are locked away, and they threw away the key. And now you have, like you just mentioned earlier, now you got this opioid epidemic. Sorry about that. And now it's all about health.
Right.
Let me chime in for 1 minute on that. A lot of black men got put away during that little crisis, but the cry for people to do something about it mostly came from the black community.
That's true. That's exactly right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's the point I was making.
Because I'm in the insurance business, and I've been in the insurance business, and I've been in other businesses, and during the early to mid 80s, drugs and selling drugs were so rampant on the Charlotte streets. I mean, I have walked through many a drug deal just to do my day-to-day business.
Yeah.
And like my oldest brother said, he said once upon a time, he said in his neighborhood, it was so terrible. He said, they couldn't even come out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing mentor work right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I would call those boys, the guys that I was mentoring with, and I said, what y'all doing? We laying on the floor. Everybody's laying on the floor. I said, why y'all laying on the floor? He said, because they're outside shooting. Drug fights right out in the middle of the streets.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, now, these Republicans or whoever, or some of these people, they planted these drugs in our communities.
Yeah.
But if something didn't happen, all of us was about to be destroyed. I hate the way they did it. I hate the way they did it.
Yeah.
But my message is this. Don't sell drugs.
Yeah.
Don't sell crack. Don't sell cocaine. Don't sell.
Yeah.
The penalty for selling crack cocaine is more severe if you're selling pure cocaine, which don't make sense. But by the same token, don't sell drugs. Don't sell either one. And the thing what you got to remember in America, the black people, black men, black women, all of us, we've always had to choose between the lesser of two evils. We've always, that's the way it's always been with us. Do we let these guys stay out here and destroy all of us, or do we put them in prison? Because you should have been in Charlotte during the 80s. It was a constant day-to-day battle right here on the streets of Charlotte. People talk about coming to Charlotte now. Place. Charlotte is bad. Charlotte ain't nowhere near bad as it was.
I was probably in the worst place in the 80s. I was probably at the murder capital right there in Southeast. What is it, Southeast or Northeast Washington, Robert? The new
Southeast?
Home.
Southeast?
Yeah, where they were
well,
dying by the
It's been
I mean,
gentrified now, but it's been gentrified now, but back then it's still Southeast,
yeah.
But it's a different place now. You wouldn't recognize it.
But see, my point is, and Joseph's right, is just we must always strive to just do the right thing. That point is indisputable. But at the same time, we have to always say this to the system and to the people who are trying to get these movements started. You have to be conscious of the fact that black folk are going to get the worst end of the deal if we are not totally conscious of what we are demanding or what we are having signed as a bill. So my point is,
if you say
we want people to stop doing drugs, that's good. But then if you have somebody to sign a bill and say, okay, three strikes, you're out. Well, wait a minute. Now, we're already being falsely accused. We're already in a system that's not fair. So we're going to get three strikes before the people over there get one strike, and they're doing the same thing. So you can't say you're going to just do three strikes if you got the same system in place. So I'm just saying we have to think this stuff through. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and,
you're right.
We need
to think these things through. But see, the thing about me, I got this thing about me. My wife said I'm going to get in trouble for this. But I don't call the police because I know if that police show up in my community or your community anywhere, and it's a black person involved, he gonna get a bad shake. So and just like the message I gave the people over at the church, you know, because there were people talking about peeping out the window and calling the police and monitoring your neighborhood and all that. I said the best way to deter drug sales is to make sure your children, after you take care of your children, and make sure your children don't get on it. Because they had this movement in Charlotte called Mothers Murdered Offspring, MOM, Mothers of Murdered Offspring. That's how rampant it was in Charlotte.
Yeah,
and I got up and I addressed them and I said, look, the best way to fight this drug epidemic is make sure your children don't get on them. That's because if you take every drug dealer off the street tonight, the only thing you're going to do is create job openings. Because as long as there's a demand, there's somebody going to supply. I say, and the police, they already know who all the drug dealers are. They already know who they are. Only time they are waiting on is a convenient time and a convenient place or when it's politically feasible to go out and pick them up.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to Brothers with Real Talk with the Brothers about politics, race relations, and voting. We are about to sign up out of here. Brothers, it's been live. I want to tell y'all this right quick before we go. You know, they were putting bombs all over CNN. They sent bombs to the Clintons. They sent bombs to the Obamas. And Trump's still out campaigning. And I don't blame him. He knows. If the blue wave comes, he's going to ride out with it, brother. Anyway, brothers, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the brothers tonight. We've been talking real talk with the brothers, the Gatewood brothers, that is. See you next Wednesday at the same time at 7 o'clock p.m. We're going to be talking about some real good stuff. Real good stuff.
Good night, brothers.
Good night, brother.
man. We don't start on the 26th.
Is that right? Yeah, I think we go up until the 3rd here, man. You know, we'll get another vote.
Yeah, I'm gonna go out. I'm gonna be in that first wave of voters. I just wanna get it, man. Vote on the book while I can in case something happens. Who knows? I might have a flat tire, car might blow up. Who knows?
And you hate to know one of these up with one by one. One vote.
No.
That'd be bad, man.
Yeah, so So you all can early vote right now?
Yeah, man. We've been voting early vote for a couple of weeks now. This week. Started last week, heading to the second week. First 2 days, man, in this small town, we had over 700 people to vote. Yeah, man. That's why they're sending people like Huckabee down here to try to make some change. He did get a little bit of pickup on his side this, you know, today. But it's tough,
me.
Man. Huh? Had a few more. You could tell that was different. More Republicans voting this week, you know, today than the past few days. So it helped a little bit. I guess I have to blame it on that. I say blame because it's blame.
Hey man, you know, that was a shooting today. I meant to talk about it. There was a shooting today.
Kentucky.
Yeah, I think it was race related.
Really?
Now the guy that was that did the shooting, there was one of this witness confronted the gunman in the parking lot with his own gun, and the gunman said, "I'm not going to shoot you. Whites don't shoot other whites." Got in his car and drove off.
Say it again.
Yeah, there was a guy in the parking lot that confronted the gunman after the shooting. And the guy said, "I'm not going to shoot you." That's what the guy that shot up the store. He told a witness, "I'm not going to shoot you because whites don't shoot other whites." And got in his car and drove off. Now this was the witness saying this, who was a white guy.
Hmm.
I said, And this happens on the same day that the Clintons and Obamas and Soroses and CNN get bombs in the mail.
Two dead, one in custody.
So, I said, man, what's going on here?
Why do you guys always end up in custody, man?
Yeah, that's. But the problem is, it's the current. We need somebody in the White House, or at least somebody who can check the person in the White House who's not only did. Well, he did make a statement today, so I'm sure his daughter probably forced him to, but. Saying that people need to stop this craziness, so I hope he does more of that for the sake of the country.
I hope he's not in there for the sake of the country.
Yeah, now that's the best thing. But as long as he's there, he's gotta because this all this talk about attacking the press, being the enemy of the people, and George Soros is funding this caravan of people coming from the South, and the Clintons and Obamas are evil, and you got some people out there that are just loose. They're not stable, and they take matters in their own hand, like these shooters and these bombers. And you got to have somebody in the White House who's responsible and understand the gravity of the situation. So, anyway, that's my story. So you saw mom today, man? What, today?
Yesterday, man. Yeah, she's doing great, man.
She doing good.
Yeah,
she was doing
good.
I was really glad last time I saw her, man. It was really nice. It was just good to see every chance I get. So I'll be back down there before the year's out.
Yeah.
So
she cool people, man.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, man, go home, man. I'm going to go home and try to eat something, man. I'm hungry as heck.
All right, man. Appreciate you, man. Good show. Good show, bro.
Yeah, man. Enjoyed it, bro. All
right, man. Later.
Yo.